You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Mao Zedong and the Communist Party defeated Chiang Kai-shek's regime in 1949, they claimed the country had been liberated from nationalism into a time of peace, liberty, and justice. In his book, The Tragedy of Liberation, A History of the Chinese Revolution, 1945 to 1957, Frank Decotter paints a very different portrait, one characterized by terror, violence, and unrest. Mr. Decotter is chair professor of humanities at the University of Hong Kong, and he was here in October to talk about this very dark time in China's history. It was a fascinating conversation, and we are re-airing it for you today. I began by pointing out that this was the second volume in a trilogy of Chinese history books that Mr. Decotter has written, but it chronologically precedes the first one, Mao's Great Famine. And I asked him, since The Tragedy of Liberation examines the beginnings of Mao's reign, why did you make it the second book?
It's a very good question. I was in the archives around about 2006 when I started researching Mao's Great Famine, because I thought that really was, as the subtitle of the book says, the greatest man-made catastrophe in human history, with something like 40, 45, or possibly even more million victims. Extraordinary.
So he had more victims than Stalin and Hitler.
Take Pol Pot, multiply that by 20, and you get somewhere near what happened in China between 1958 and 1962. Extraordinary event. But as I was working on this topic, news came about construction workers in Manchuria, a city called Changchun. They were digging up a road, and underneath about a meter of that rich black Manchurian soil, they found thousands of skeletons very closely packed together. These were the remnants of the civil war when Changchun had been besieged by the communists for 5 months in 1948, leading to some 160,000 civilians being starved to death. And that triggered my interest in that whole period.
Now, had that that period been buried, literally, in the same way that these bodies had been buried?
Well, that's the conclusion I reached, that I had to do a little bit of my own archaeological digging inside the party archives in China because nobody else had actually done it. After decades of propaganda about the peaceful liberation of China, very few people today, inside China or outside, remember the victims of the rise to power of the Communist Party. That whole period, you could walk into any bookshop and find books on the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, but where's the Chinese Revolution in all of this? Where's 1949 and the first years of that regime with which we still have to deal today?
Changchun was blockaded, as you say, by communist troops for 5 months. Why was it targeted, and what did the blockade entail?
It was the very first city that the communists encountered on their march down from the north of Manchuria. What happened is that after Hiroshima was erased in a blinding flash of light on the 6th of August, 1945, a couple of days later, Stalin invaded Manchuria, and he handed it pretty much over to the communists who occupied the countryside. Changchun is the very first city that the communists start attacking. And when they realized that the garrison stationed inside the city walls would not surrender, the man in charge, called Lin Biao, decided that Changchun had to be literally starved to death. So he put a sentry every 40 meters along barbed wire, trenches 4 meters deep. Nobody could escape from that city. It was a siege that lasted a full 5 months.
And did everyone die?
Not everybody died. About 160,000 victims. There is actually a lieutenant in the People's Liberation Army called Zhang Zhenglong, who pretty much documented the siege. And he said Hiroshima was the same as Changchun. Hiroshima took 9 seconds. Changchun took 5 months. The number of victims was the same.
Was Lin Biao, well, what happened to him after that? Was he decorated for doing something like this?
Well, he's one of the great generals of the People's Liberation Army, seen as an absolutely brilliant strategist. Of course, once Changchun fell, no other city wanted to undergo the same fate. So within a matter of months, Beijing actually surrendered itself. And then one after the other, 1948, 49, all these cities fall.
And there seemed to have been relief when Shanghai fell to the communists, not because the city wanted to be taken over, but because it happened with relatively little violence.
Of course, sheer fear that the city might be besieged and starved into surrender as well.
Now, how do you find this information? Some of these stories here are just horrific, and I'd imagine that they have either the documents have been destroyed or they've been largely buried.
One-party states, and the one in China is no different, are obsessed with information and with secrecy. They are vast bureaucracies, and they document pretty much everything and anything, from the rumors about your next-door neighbor to the siege of Changchun. So there's an immense wealth inside the party archives of China.
Is Mao's memory still being protected?
Very much so.
But things are being declassified today, aren't they?
Yes, thanks to that.
Which would cause his reputation to be a bit more tarnished now.
A little tarnished. Sometimes I get accused of painting too grim a picture, both in my first book, Mao's Great Famine, but also in this one, The Tragedy of Liberation. But my answer is always that if it's so grim, what is there in those files which still remained classified beyond the reach of historians? What's in there?
Well, you live in Hong Kong, which is, in theory, part of China today. Does that mean that you are sometimes subject to censorship?
Not really. Hong Kong, what is Hong Kong? It's a city built by wave after wave of refugees, all of them from the People's Republic of China during the Second World War, and again in 1949 as the red flag goes up over the Forbidden City in Beijing, during the famine, during the Cultural Revolution, after Tiananmen Square. So Hong Kong is the place where the most outspoken critics are.
The Chinese Communist Party calls its 1949 Civil War victory a liberation. Wasn't China in pretty bad shape during the years that Chiang Kai-shek was in power?
It was in bad shape after the Japanese occupation, as was Europe, of course. But there was a Marshall Plan to help Europe. What happened in China is that after 1945, there was a very vicious war between the communists and the nationalists. Now, the nationalists would have been able to count on the support of the Americans, but they imposed an arms embargo in September 1946, pretty much abandoning Chiang Kai-shek to his own fate, where Stalin massively backed up the communists in Manchuria.
Now, why did the United States abandon Chiang Kai-shek? Because Madam Chiang was something of a celebrity in this country. Henry Luce was celebrating her regularly in Time magazine.
Absolutely. They had their fans and their supporters here. But overall, the Americans were just disillusioned with the nationalists. And most of all, they knew very little about the communists, seeing them somehow as agrarian reformers rather than the Soviet-backed communists that they were at the time.
And there were some people who, from the U.S. military, who'd gone to China, join Mao and sent back positive reports.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You write that communist rule in every important town was inaugurated with a carefully choreographed procession. What did it look like?
It looked like a fanfare. It's opened by soldiers, invariably, and then followed by a truck with a large portrait of Mao Zedong, and then dancers who come and swing their bodies to music played by heavy gongs, trumpets, waist drums, and, of course, waving red flags. It's fanfare. It's a celebration.
But to some degree, it sounds like the sort of thing we see at a Chinese New Year celebration.
Indeed. Of course, at the time, most people didn't just clap and applaud. They stood back, feeling relief that the Civil War was over, but also having hope that somehow this fanfare would lead to an era of peace and stability.
And just a day after Shanghai fell, trams and buses started running again. Policemen started directing traffic again. The sidewalk stands were once again filled with vegetables. Was that restoration of services part of Mao's strategy?
Yeah, it will last for about a couple of weeks. And then, of course, the police knocks on your door. They invite themselves into your home. They're there to ferret out forbidden weapons that range from radios to hidden weapons. And most of all, they will give you a class label. They will say that you belong to a revolutionary class, a so-called middle class, or a bad class that could be capitalist or landlord. And from that moment onwards, if you are classified as a bad person, capitalist, landlord, you will not fare very well for very long.
And not just you, but members of your family, your children. How far
indeed
did that go?
Well, the extraordinary
If you were the grandchild of somebody who had owned a major business, were you ruined for life?
You were pretty much ruined within years. And, of course, the label that you are given as landlord or capitalist is inherited. So the strange thing is that if you are classified as a landlord, even though you have been expropriated, if not killed, and you don't have any land left, your son, 20 years later, could still be classified and treated as a landlord.
So, as you mentioned earlier, by the time Chiang Kai-shek resigned as president in 1949, he was kind of forced to resign?
It was pretty much the end of the road for the nationalists. As they get defeated again and again and again, there's this massive army that comes from Manchuria and wages a pitiless war of attrition. Chiang Kai-shek couldn't defeat them. Of course, the Americans couldn't either a year later in Korea.
Everywhere people, you say, were apathetic, beaten down by inflation, heavy taxes, sometimes openly hostile to the nationalists. But most of all, people were tired of war. Were they welcoming of the communists, or did they just see this as more of the same with a different political bent?
Well, I think there was a lot of hope. Don't forget that Mao, like Lenin and the Bolsheviks some 40 years earlier, had come to power by promising every disaffected group what they wanted most, which meant land for the farmers, freedom for intellectuals, protection of private property for entrepreneurs, and, of course, better working conditions for workers.
But soon after the parades ended, the police moved in. There were curfews. Citizens started reporting on their neighbors in hopes of gaining some reward. So very quickly, was there a disillusionment?
Within weeks, the tone changes. Newspapers are forced to shut down. Dance halls are converted into factories. And most of all, every adult has to go back to school, learn the new ideology. People are asked to transform themselves into new people.
And you're right that during this time, almost overnight, half the population seemed to have become communist. Was that because they saw that as the way that they were going to save themselves, or because people who were perceived as enemies to the new regime were quietly jailed or executed, as you say many were?
Very quickly, people realized that they had better not stand on the sidelines and at least give a show of active voluntary participation rather than be targeted as an enemy of the regime.
You're right. But let's say somebody who was a member of the wrong kind of family, but was an idealist and thought the communists had the right ideas, would that person still be in jeopardy?
There is no end to the number of people who are true believers and take on board all these promises made by the Communist Party. Even by 1957, the last year in this book, there are those who are actually being sent to the Gulag, the Great Northern Wilderness, absolutely convinced that they are at fault and they should examine their innermost thoughts and they should transform themselves into new people.
You write that the nationalists had a sophisticated prison network. How did the prison camps that Mao instituted differ from them?
Well, just in terms of sheer quantity, of course, the nationalists have a reasonably sophisticated system, but it is nowhere near enough. They only have about enough place for about 50,000 prisoners. Within a year, there are about 1 million or 2 million people lingering in the gulag that stretches all across China from, you know, these rough Manchurian wilderness all the way down to the deserts of Gansu province. But most of all, it's the emphasis on so-called thought reform. If you end up in a labor camp, you are constantly subjected to thought reform. A number of Americans are thrown into jail, accused of being spies. They come out completely renewed as Maoists. They proclaim their faith into Maoism, even here in the United States.
And that led to the term brainwashing, although there are many people who believe there is no such thing.
And, of course, the term Manchurian candidate.
Well,
the idea that some of them might be, so brainwashed that they might attack somebody in the United States.
My guest is Frank Decotta. He is chair professor of humanities at the University of Hong Kong. His latest book, The Tragedy of Liberation, A History of the Chinese Revolution, 1945 to 1957, is published by Bloomsbury Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. Later on in this hour, historian Jill Lepore introduces us to Benjamin Franklin's remarkable sister, Jane. She was a gifted writer and a shrewd political commentator. You're listening to WNYC, WNYC.org. We're back with a conversation I had in October with Frank Dikotter, D-I-K-O-T-T-E-R. He was here to talk about his book, The Tragedy of Liberation, A History of the Chinese Revolution, 1945 to 1957. I started the second part of that interview by talking about those who were most at risk, which included some obvious ones, those sorted by class as well as the people who had worked with the previous government. But some of the executions were truly horrific. There were reports of people being drowned in vats of salt water. One man, whose surname meant ox, was forced to be driven around like an ox with a wire through his nose by his son and then branded and locked into a cave where he died 8 days later. And I asked Frank Dikotter, why did they make those executions so elaborate?
This was part of land reform. And what we've misunderstood for so long is that land reform wasn't just about distributing the land. It was about making sure that a majority of villagers actually killed themselves, their own elected village leaders. The communists forced the village to polarize itself into two antagonistic groups. What Mao did was really make sure that everybody had blood on their hands. A sufficient quantity of blood had to be shed for a return to the old order to become impossible.
And this was something that he actually ordered?
Pretty much so. Land reform was violence. Violence was intrinsic to the revolution. It was necessary to make sure that the pact with the poor was sealed literally in blood.
And the land reform, was it modeled on the Soviet collective farms?
Not quite. Of course, Stalin used the public security forces to get rid of the kulaks, or the rich peasants, but Mao wanted the villagers to do it themselves.
You also write about a writer named Wang Shiwei, who was considered a political dissident, and it's reported that he was chopped to pieces and thrown into a well in 1947.
Yes.
Again, a brutal murder.
Brutal.
Now, in the Soviet Union, when things went bad, people would say, if Uncle Joe only knew that this was happening, he'd be outraged. And, of course, Uncle Joe was behind them.
Yes.
Same with Mao.
There are reports in 1947, a report by Liu Shaoqi, who's one of the great leaders at the time, who reports that people were being buried alive, dismembered, hung from trees, nailed against doors. Extraordinary violence. The children of people labeled landlords were persecuted as little landlords.
Didn't some people survive by writing confessions?
Of course. Most of all, people survived by somehow taking the side of the Communist Party and by denouncing their neighbors because they had no choice. Nobody was allowed to stay on the sidelines.
And then there were also relocations. Why were people being moved around the country?
Well, it was the plan to develop the countryside, but also because the countryside very quickly became the dumping ground for all undesirables. So the cities are emptied of those the party sees as a threat to its social order, not just vagabonds, pickpockets, prostitutes, but of course also millions of disbanded soldiers and refugees.
Well, most of the people, I assume, had no idea what communism even meant or what Mao had in mind. So how were things worked out?
They took him at his word. They believed his promises for peace, stability, a better age, protection of freedom, private property.
What happened in the towns and villages?
Very soon after land reform came to an end, round about 1950, Mao sends his troops into Korea. So it's the start of a new war, despite the promise of peace. And this happens round about October 1950. And he uses the war in Korea as a pretext to really regiment his own society. He sees or believes that there are all sorts of enemies in the path of revolution, Kuomintang remnants, spies, bandits, counter-revolutionaries, and he actually orders 1 per 1,000 in the entire population to be executed.
How well did the Red Army fight?
Very well, very well.
The reason that the Korean War ended in a stalemate, despite the fact that the United States was fighting on the side of the South.
It's a war of attrition that starts very much in Manchuria against the nationalists. And, of course, once 200,000 of his troops cross into Korea on the 18th of October and attack Americans a week later, the Americans themselves are confronted with wave after wave of people who attack them.
Hadn't there been rebellions against land reform and the landlords? A lot of people were angry at the Communist Party. Was the Korean War a way of getting past that? Because Mao had written in 1950, you report, the entire country is tense. We are rather lonely.
Yes, he knew himself that the Communist Party did not have the support of the majority of the population. And what is so extraordinary about the archives, which one can now access with great limitations, but still extraordinary documentation compiled by the party itself that shows that right away after liberation in 1949-1950, there were tremendous uprisings in the countryside. East China, 40 rebellions within the three first months of 1950. One county in Hunan, 10,000 farmers surround the county seat.
My guest is Frank DeCotter. His book, The Tragedy of Liberation, A History of the Chinese Revolution, 1945-1957, is published by Bloomsbury Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, around the same time as the Korean War, we get the Great Terror. Why was it initiated?
Again, Mao uses the war to regiment this population, seeing enemies everywhere. It starts in the countryside, but very quickly it moves on to the cities. And the most extraordinary thing about this campaign of terror is that it's all done by quotas, like steel production or grain output. Death here comes with a quota mandated from above. Mao says kill 1 per 1,000. And before you know it, some of these willing executioners on the ground start vying to outdo that quota. They want to fulfill and overfulfill the plan. So by the time that you reach the end of 1951, up to 3 per 1,000 of people in entire provinces like Guizhou, the size of France, are being publicly executed.
Some executions took place in public, and while family members were often allowed to collect the bodies afterward, in many places the remains were blown up by dynamite?
Yes. This is extraordinary. These executions are supposed to reflect the wrath of the people against counter-revolutionaries or evil tyrants. But all too often, local party members on the ground start assassinating their own enemies covertly. So in one place where 10 people are declared to be enemies of the state and executed in a stadium, over 100 are covertly assassinated. Entire villages are razed from the ground.
So in some cases, this was a way of getting rid of people who you couldn't get rid of any other way. But also, I suspect, it was also a way of sending a message. If you don't conform, if you don't just go along with the way things are, you could just as easily be executed in public.
Anybody and everybody could become a victim.
And you write that even those who survived the terror continued to live in fear. But you also say that although the campaign ended officially in 1951, the killings never really stopped. How long did they go on?
Well, they go on for quite some time. As Mao really goes down a list, so to speak, of enemies, every social group has to be subdued. The first ones are, of course, the farmers themselves, the villagers in the countryside. But before
But they were the ones who he claimed he was doing all of this for.
Indeed. And his second target are the very party members themselves. As Mao in 1952 wishes to cleanse the ranks of the party, and has several top leading party officials executed in public, shot in the heart rather than in the head as a concession to their status.
Also, he was suspicious of intellectuals.
intellectuals are also next in 1952. But then again, when you look at it more closely, a witch hunt virtually every year until 1957, when, of course, Deng Xiaoping, as we know, labels about 500,000 intellectuals as rightists, meaning counter-revolutionaries, and sends a great number of them to the gulag.
If they made any attempt to contact people outside of the country, they were accused of espionage?
Absolutely. Having a contact with anybody outside the country is bad news.
I once interviewed a Chinese man who was studying engineering at the University of Chicago in 1949, and he responded to Mao's call for anyone who had skills that could help the revolution to return and help rebuild China. Not long after he returned, he was put into prison as an American spy, and he was only released after Mao died.
It's awful. And there's so many similar stories. And we know so much about the Cultural Revolution that happened after 1966, and so little about people who were victims of the communist rule right away in 1949 or in the following years.
What about foreigners who were living in China? There were many people who had escaped the Soviet Union, others who had escaped Hitler in Europe. Were they also treated with suspicion?
Well, this is the extraordinary thing. We tend to think of China today in terms of refugees coming from China to Europe or to the United States. But at the time, before the communist conquest, there were literally hundreds of thousands of Russians, of Europeans, who were refugees there, who had taken China as their home. They left in droves if they could. Many were expelled. Quite a few ended up in prison.
What about Russians who were sympathetic to Stalin? Were they treated as allies?
Well, they were treated as allies, but of course they were also seen to be very suspicious.
Well, to some extent, didn't Russian films and literature replace foreign cinema and the books that had been burned by Mao?
It is a Soviet-backed conquest, and Mao learns pretty much everything from the Soviet Union. The people are trained already in the 1930s on how to operate a public security system.
Since the Soviet Union had supported Mao, why was Mao's relationship with Stalin somewhat contentious?
Well, because, of course, on the one hand, Stalin wishes to support Mao, but is very afraid of some giant communist power emerging right on his doorstep. Whereas Mao, on the other hand, realizes that Stalin is a little bit suspicious, does his very best to prove his allegiance to the cause, but of course thinks that he, rather than Stalin, is a much greater revolutionary.
And you write that Stalin's death was Mao's liberation.
Absolutely. Mao thinks that Stalin may be some big shot leading the communist camp, but it is Mao who fought the Americans to a standstill.
Do we know what Mao thought about Nikita Khrushchev's speech in 1955 after Stalin died?
It was a blow to his reputation. When Khrushchev denounces Stalin, the reign of terror, collectivization of the countryside, he perceives it as a direct attack on himself. He, after all, is the Stalin of China.
And had he already pushed the cult of personality at this point?
Very much so. Very much so.
Then he did something else. He initiated the 100 Flowers campaign.
It's a great coup. Within a mere 2 months, he reinvents himself and actually manages to outdo Khrushchev by posing as the champion of the ordinary man, by protecting the freedom of speech, by actually encouraging the party to accept more freedom among intellectuals. And he says, let 100 flowers bloom, let 100 schools contend. He, rather than Khrushchev, is now the one who strikes the much more liberal, conciliatory tone.
And then people foolishly actually believed him.
And they go along. Workers go on strike. Farmers leave the collectives. And in the thousands, sometimes up to a third of these villages take back the land that they believe belongs to them, take it back from the state, and cultivate their own plots. Intellectuals are a little prudent, but when egged on again in February 57, it's a torrent of criticism.
A writer from Romania once told me that when Ceausescu said that he was ending censorship, that was the dangerous time, because before then, they knew what the rules were, they knew what they could say and what they couldn't say, but once there was so-called freedom of speech, they were all vulnerable to being arrested.
And this is exactly what happened. There is a man called Robert Lowe who appears in the book on several occasions. He's been preparing his escape from China. And when he hears Mao talk about freedom of speech, he's really smitten. He's taken aback. He thinks, oh, my God, I shouldn't flee. This is the turning moment. This is the moment when China is becoming truly democratic.
So how long did that campaign last?
The freedom of speech lasts for about a couple of weeks. And then Mao Zedong puts a tough little man called Deng Xiaoping in charge of a ruthless campaign against these intellectuals. That's 500,000 of them are declared counter-revolutionaries.
The same Deng Xiaoping who later is seen as the man who modernized China after Mao's death.
The same Deng Xiaoping who sends the tanks to Tiananmen Square.
But who also had been punished during the Cultural Revolution.
Yes, indeed.
So it was
but all of
anyone, no one was safe.
All of them get punished during the Cultural Revolution. Every single one of them gets punished. Punishment is not a measure. Deng Xiaoping, of course, was one of the truest followers of Mao during the 1950s.
You get the feeling that in terms of terror, there were the equivalent of five-year plans. The next thing is the Great Leap Forward in 1958, a campaign that you call the greatest man-made catastrophe.
Indeed.
And then we have the Cultural Revolution
yes.
in 1966, another yes. great catastrophe.
Yes. It's three decades of awfulness, as much as there was awfulness under Stalin from the very beginning to the very end.
Do you think that Mao gets a free pass in a way? Because when we talk about the villains of the 20th century, the first names that come to mind are Hitler and Stalin.
Yep. It's very easy. It's called the Mao T-shirt question. Do we see T-shirts with Mao on it? Yes, we do. Do we see T-shirts with Pol Pot on it? I don't think we do.
We do see T-shirts with Che Guevara.
I've seen once a man in Hong Kong wear a T-shirt with Adolf Hitler on it.
There is an Italian winemaker who actually makes wines with pictures of Hitler and Goering and Goebbels, but that's a whole other issue. Does any of the communist culture in China from this time period, 45 to 57, continue to exist today?
Well, the most amazing thing is that after I finished writing the book a year ago, of course, there was a new administration in the People's Republic. And it's not just that Xi Jinping and Bo Xilai on trial are the children of Bo Weibo and Xi Zhongxun at the time. It is that the regime today is really looking at the 1950s as a kind of toolkit, if you wish, for techniques of power. It's a one-party state. It can only do that much. It can't, well, look at the Cultural Revolution as a great success. So the leaders themselves are looking at the 1950s in order to find ways of dealing with issues. For instance, right now we have an anti-corruption campaign. And right now we have a rectification campaign and people are compelled to write their self-criticism.
Frank Decarta is Chair Professor of Humanities at the University of Hong Kong. His book, The Tragedy of Liberation, A History of Chinese Revolution, 1945 to 1957, is published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.